This is The End User, episode 183 for Thursday, October 2nd, the Windows Q Continuum. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
And Taylor, we're live once again on Wednesday night, and we have a full week of tech news to talk about. Microsoft's in the top of the news with a new version of Windows, and I think we'll have a good podcast this week.
A new version of Windows. Oh, wow. That's pretty exciting. So should we start with that?
No, we've got a little bit of feedback to get through first, and then we'll get into the top news. So we've got a comment on the show post from a BlackBerry enthusiast. I'm not quite sure how to say his name. It's EALVNV is his handle. And he brings up some pretty good points that we kind of missed on the BlackBerry Passport last week. So he says, hey guys, in your talk about the BlackBerry Passport, you forgot to mention what is probably the most important and innovative feature about the keyboard. It is a touch-sensitive keyboard that functions as a trackpad for scrolling on web pages or applications without the need to touch the screen at all. You can swipe up for the predictive text or swipe right or left to delete words. So, good point there. We didn't talk about that, and that is really cool. So,
yeah, I didn't even know that part. That's really awesome. That's a smart way to integrate a physical keyboard into the modern touchscreen era.
Yeah, and I think it harkens back to BlackBerry's roots of the scroll wheel, right? The scroll wheel was traditionally how you interacted with the BlackBerry in the first place, and I feel like it's kind of a harken back to that. And it from the videos that I've seen of it, it seems to work pretty well. I really like it. It's cool.
Yeah, as opposed to the scroll wheel, which actually never worked very well.
Well, no, it worked really well for email. For its purpose, in its day, it worked quite well.
Well, I mean, it worked well on a new BlackBerry, but after 2 years, it usually stopped functioning to a degree.
Yeah. So in the next bit of his comment, he's talking about running Android apps, and he says there's no need to tailor anything unless your app requires Google services. And we were talking about whether or not the user experience of Android apps through the Amazon store would be good on the BlackBerry device. And I kind of hold on that one. I think that getting all of the Android apps through Amazon and scaling it to the BlackBerry Passport screen is probably not going to be as good as a user experience as a native Android app on a native phone.
There's no way an Android developer could have predicted that their app is going to be run on this BlackBerry with this super high resolution square screen. You might download the app and it'll just render funny because it's not designed for that. And that's all that we were really getting at. Obviously, it's amazing and useful and productive that you have access to so many Android apps on the BlackBerry. It's just the problem is that some of them are not going to look good, and you might not be able to fix that.
Yeah, and they will be there and they will technically work, and maybe that's enough to get the job done, but it won't be the kind of delightful user experience that you would be used to using a native application designed for the platform you're using. So it will technically work, but I think it leaves the user experience out of the equation. So lastly, he points us in an interesting direction where there's an application called Snap where you can load Google Play Store applications. If you sideload the Snap application onto your BlackBerry, then you can actually load Google Play apps on the BlackBerry. So that's kind of a hack around. And, you know, I'm not sure of the legality of all of that, but it's kind of an interesting option.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it's good to know that if you get this BlackBerry Passport, that it's not really hardware limited to run only certain kinds of Android apps. To have the full catalog, at least of free apps, that's pretty great.
Yeah, and again, I really doubt that you're not breaking Google's terms of service by doing that. So, I you know, I'm no lawyer, but I doubt that is going to be a legal option. But somebody's out there and somebody did it. So that's kind of interesting. So anyway, thank you for your comment. Neither of us are that experienced on the BlackBerry platform, so you bring up a lot of good points there. So with that, let's get into the top news. Let's talk about the next version of Windows.
Cool. Yeah, I was really excited. I read this article that it's really great. It says Microsoft is skipping Windows 9 because it's too good, and so they're jumping directly to Windows 10.
Yeah, so that was actually, you know, that was actually an April Fool's joke from 2013. So I think you kind of missed that one.
So they are going to release Windows 9?
No, it turns out the April Fool's joke from 2013 is actually turning true. So they're deciding to skip a number, and they're deciding to go with the moniker Windows 10. Because who doesn't like 10?
Sure, 10 is great. I like 9, though.
You wanted to see 9?
Well, yeah, according to this April Fool's article, 9 was really awesome.
Yeah, and according to the April Fool's article, at least, they were testing it internally, and they said, this is too good to let out into the wild. We can't let people know about this.
So if they're releasing 10 and not 9, that must be the reason why.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. Well, no. So in all seriousness, Microsoft is releasing a Windows 10, and they've got a bunch of kind of interesting features. But at the highest level possible, looking at this, I think it's kind of interesting that they were really focused on power user kind of features. They're not talking about the real consumer aspect of this quite yet. And there were some things that were kind of mass market and consumer in it, but they're talking about things like multiple desktops and that kind of thing that your average consumer just will never use. And I kind of like that, though. That's a good departure from the let's make everything simple and secretly make it more complicated in trying to make it simple. And I think that is kind of a good direction for them to go in.
Yeah, I do agree about the simplicity. But I had a really different takeaway from this. From what I've seen so far, they seem to be focusing on platform and input agnosticity.
Well, yes. So that's the other part of it.
Well, that seems to be the main part to me, and it makes a lot of sense. Windows 8 was, they sort of designed it to kind of bridge the gap between a PC and a tablet. And then there's Windows Phone 8, and now they're saying Windows 10 is just going to be one operating system across all of these.
Yeah, and I believe Windows Phone at the moment at least shares the kernel of the operating system. So there is something shared, but it looks like they're going to go a little bit further. And the information on what the future of Windows Phone is going to be is a little light at the moment. So we're going to have some more information, you know, as the days go by here. They're kind of pledging to release and work in the public and get people's feedback in a way that they just haven't done before. So again, quite the opposite of the way the whole start menu debacle went down, and that was kind of secret until they unveiled it, and then they had trouble kind of backing away from it, which they're clearly doing with this release. They're backing away from the Metro apps, as it were. So
yeah, they're going back to the start menu, and they're putting live tiles into the start menu.
Right, and so yeah, so we've got the start menu, and it looks a little more like the Windows 7 start menu in that it is a rectangular menu on the bottom left of the screen. What they've kind of done is when you open the menu, they've got off to the right, there's a little panel for live tiles that's reminiscent of the Windows 8 start screen. So if you're using the device that you're using in desktop mode, then you've got this start menu with a little live tile area for like weather notifications and that kind of thing, or weather tiles and that kind of thing. And then if you're using the phone, device in tablet mode, then you do get the kind of full screen start menu that is from Windows 8.1 right now. Now, what's interesting is in both cases in the videos that I saw, the taskbar at the bottom was still present. So if they're targeting tablets and the taskbar is still present, I think that's a little weird.
Yeah, it's kind of unclear. I haven't seen any mock-ups of what the tablet or phone or the even the Xbox versions of Windows 10 are supposed to look like. We've kind of only seen the desktop. But I would imagine they would do something more like the modern UI interface as opposed to the taskbar.
Yeah, I'd have to imagine that they would hide the taskbar if you were in a pure tablet mode. So the other thing is that they're backing off of the whole Metro app thing, sort of. So when you open a modern app or Metro app or whatever you want to call it, they open in a windowed mode, and the app they showed off was Mail, and it was designed to be responsive. You know how if you shrink a website down, a lot of times it'll turn into this kind of mobile version as you shrink it down? The app kind of responded in the same way, so that apparently you can design these apps to scale in a way that that will go down in screen resolution to very small and to very large.
I've never seen a website do that. I can think of some apps that do it.
Yeah, in fact, my personal site does it. So if you go to barnesian.com and you just take the window and you shrink it down in width, eventually you'll get to the phone app size.
And it'll just reload and switch over?
No. It doesn't even reload. It's just the way it looks just changes immediately.
Huh, okay, cool.
And there's actually a bunch of sites that do that that you probably never noticed, because what happens is if you go to them on a phone, they look like a phone app, and if you go to them on a desktop, they don't.
Right, I'm not going to shrink my desktop browser windows down to 300 pixels.
Yeah, you wouldn't actually do that in real life, right?
Apparently, I never have.
But so anyway, the native applications for Windows 10 have this kind of it's called responsive design, right? And they have this kind of idea that depending on what device you open them on, they will look different. And it's very similar to how a lot of web applications are doing it nowadays.
Cool. I like it.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of good ideas there. Now, I guess one last thing we'll talk about is they're calling this a continuum, in that you can use the same app on a smaller device and on a larger device, and it'll respond like we've been talking about. Now, the start menu will also be in that way. So if you plug in a keyboard, for example, you will immediately be in desktop mode and you'll have a start menu. And then if you remove the keyboard, you will immediately be in the kind of full screen mode. So I thought that was kind of cool, that it asks you, it says, oh, I see you removed the keyboard. Do you want to switch to this full screen tablet mode? And you say yes. And then when you click the start menu, it's the full screen kind of Windows 8 kind of interface. So
Your question about the taskbar.
Well, no. So when I saw them demo it, when it went into the full screen mode, the taskbar at the bottom remained, but it was full screen. So again, if there's a device that you're only using as a touchscreen, I'd imagine that the taskbar would go away. But from the demo that I saw, it in fact did not. But I have to imagine that it would go away.
Well, it probably depends on where in the continuum you are.
Yes. Yes, the Microsoft Windows continuum. It's not a continuum.
If you're in the Q continuum, you don't even need screens at all.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Windows Q. That'd be fun.
Oh, there it is. I like that.
No screens necessary.
Microsoft should hire you.
Just snap your fingers.
You can be the naming director of Microsoft. I like it.
I would kick butt at that job.
I think you would. And you'd have you'd have Windows Volte and all kinds of things like that. All right, so again, they're promising to kind of work in the open and take some user feedback, and they're releasing a technical preview, which is now available. I haven't gotten a chance to download it quite yet, so I'll be doing that probably tomorrow, and kind of check it out. So it's a really early version of Windows 10, and hopefully we're going to see some more details going forward as they kind of develop this.
Yeah, so When can people try out Windows 10, and when is it actually going to come out for real?
So that's now. You can get the technical preview now, and we're not quite sure when Windows 10 is going to ship for good. Oh, and let's talk about one more thing. They had a kind of interesting bit where if you launched the task switcher, that it was greatly improved. It reminded me a lot of the OS X expose, where you get a live preview of all of the windows kind of floating next to each other. And then below, you actually had the multiple desktops that I mentioned previously. So you can switch between these virtual desktops. And it just reminded me a lot of expose.
Chris, expose was iterations ago. We call it mission control now.
I know. But the first time I saw that, it was called expose. But yeah, you're right. It's mission control, and it does a little bit more than that now.
It does quite a bit more, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of cool. I think no matter how you look at it, that is probably a good way of doing things with a kind of task manager, task switcher. And I think it's a good way of doing things, even if it's coming from the Apple camp.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Windows 10 for now. We'll get some more details as they come about. It's going to be more of a trickle than a big one-shot announcement.
Well, speaking of trickles, it looks like we've got a new app for Microsoft Office.
Yeah, so this is kind of a neat looking app. It's called it's kind of out of the blue for me. It's called Sway, and it's something of a PowerPoint replacement, and you get to you get this notion of collaborative editing as well. And it seems like a cool little product. They've got a demo site at sway.com that you can check out. You can give them your email and sign up to have them notify you when it's complete. But it's some mix of like PowerPoint, and you can live edit and add photos and stuff like that. So there's some aspect of Google Drive in there. They've got some other media features that are involved in that, and it's kind of a hodgepodge of things.
Cool. Have you tried it out yet?
No, so I haven't gotten a chance to try it out, because it was just today that this thing dropped, so I haven't gotten a chance.
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. I think it could fill some gaps in between, like, what PowerPoint and other presentation software are offering.
And it's more immersive than PowerPoint, right? I mean, this is an app where you can make this thing, a slide of some sort or a document, kind of, and you can, you know, tweet it, right? And it's somewhere in between. I think that's right.
Yeah, it's almost like more like an ebook maker, but an interactive one.
That's a good call. I think that's pretty accurate. Or maybe like a e-magazine maker, something like that.
Yeah, but those aren't real.
Yeah, but those don't exist. Yeah.
and it doesn't make magazines.
Right, but it's kind of a strange app, but I like how it, just from the demo video, I like what they're after here. It feels modern in a way none of the Office apps really do.
From the one picture that I can see so far, that appears to be true.
Yeah, so we'll have to see if this actually goes anywhere. It does kind of smell like Google Wave, doesn't it? Like, I feel like this is something they're throwing out, and maybe if it's a hit, they'll keep it, and if not, they'll get rid of it or something.
Well, I hope so, and I hope not, because I really liked Google Wave.
Yeah, I know. I really liked Google Wave, too.
I miss it.
Yeah, it was so great.
We used it to put together this podcast for as long as we could.
Yeah, it was so great at editing podcast notes, that's for sure.
All right, so if you want to check it out, you can go to sway.com and presumably try it for free.
Yeah, there's a little video there that you can watch, too, that kind of demos, you know, what you can do with this. And so pretty cool. Give it a try. So with that, should we get out of the Microsoft news and get into the afterburners?
Sure. Let me just get my seatbelt on, and I'll be ready to go.
All right.
So I'm ready.
If you are securely fastened, why don't you kick us off?
All right. So we had mentioned before that Verizon was planning to throttle the internet speeds of LTE users on its network, even if they had unlimited data. They weren't cutting people off, but they were saying your LTE access is going to be limited after a certain amount of data. Now, the FCC pushed back on this, and Verizon has changed their stance so that people who are on grandfathered unlimited plans with LTE devices will continue getting unlimited data at the throttling rate that they were already receiving.
Yeah, and for this is the plan that I used to have, and the throttling rate was none. So they hadn't even thought about that when they rolled out those data plans. So it's full LTE all the time, unlimited.
Yeah.
So that's how it should be. Once you sign a contract, that contract specifies that it exists until somebody violates the contract in some way or drops the service. And so I think it's the right thing to do. So I guess the FCC's pressure worked in this case.
For once.
For once. So TiVo has updated its Android app, and it's going to allow video streaming now, which is very cool. I love this. So you can stream video from your TiVo to your Android phone now, both recorded TV and live TV. And even better, not only can you do it inside of your home network, apparently you can do it outside of your home network. So that's a little wild. I'm not sure how they're doing that, but definitely cool stuff to see from TiVo.
Yeah, that's pretty great. And if it works as seamlessly as they advertise, that's totally a killer feature. Now, there is a new thumb drive for your television, so to speak, like a Chromecast. Or what's Microsoft's new thing they're calling it?
The Miracast dongle. I forget exactly what its name was.
So if you are a Firefox user as opposed to a Chrome user, you don't want a Chromecast, you can now pick up a Firefox-centric dongle for your TV called the Matchstick.
And yeah, so presumably this has integration with the Firefox OS. That you can get on a very limited set of devices instead of the Google ecosystem. So it at least looks cool.
Yeah, it does look really cool. Not that you would see it because it just lives behind your television. You can't actually get it yet. It is a Kickstarter right now, but they have almost reached their funding as of the time of this recording.
Yeah, so it's very likely that they will.
Yeah, I think they totally will.
So I guess their goal is to bring kind of web technologies into this device and get some kind of media streaming goodness. So I think that's a pretty good goal. So on Kickstarter now, if you like it, go back them.
All right. Now, if you are a Google user and specifically a Chromebook user, you've got some new features available to you now. Adobe is adding Photoshop and the rest of their Creative Cloud suite onto Chrome OS. So they're going to be available on Chromebooks. And it works online. It's a web app. So you can access it through adobe.com. And right now you can apply for free access to the beta.
I feel like Chromebooks are the computing device that is sneaking up on everyone. You know, they keep getting more powerful and they keep getting these kind of apps that are essential to a lot of people who use computers. So that's cool. That's cool to see some kind of version of Photoshop available for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Canadians rejoice. You now have access to Spotify. So Spotify is a internet radio service that the U.S. has enjoyed for quite a long time now. And I believe it started in the U.K., didn't it?
But I'm not sure. I don't think so. I had it in pretty early here in the States.
Yeah, it was really big in Europe before it was in the United States, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, it's now in Canada. So if you're Canadian and you're listening to this podcast, you can throw up your hands in rejoice if you are a music listener. So go check it out.
Yeah, but finish listening to the podcast first, and then you can start listening to Spotify.
Yes. Yeah, please do. So another notable country release, the Xbox One has finally launched in China. So that's good to see. So once again, if you're Chinese and you're listening to us, then the throw up your hands and rejoice because you can now purchase the Xbox One. That's a pretty big step, and that's a pretty big market too.
And also, xie xie, thank you for listening.
So HP has released some details on their newest line of what appear to be kind of netbook-like devices and a couple tablets. They've got a 7-inch tablet that's only $100. They've got an 8-inch tablet that's only $150. They've got an 11.6-inch laptop for $200 and a 13.3-inch laptop for $230. So they'll be available.
Boy, are they colorful.
Yes, they're very... They remind me of what was it? The iPod Nano that were in all kinds of colors. So they're available in the... They told us sometime in November, so we're not quite sure what that actually means, but that's what we know for now. And again, these are really, really cheap devices that are kind of down market, and they all are running some flavor of Windows 8.1, both the tablets and the laptops. And that's kind of a cool little lineup for some super cheap computing devices. You know, don't expect a MacBook Pro out of these, but it's nice to have the option, I suppose.
They also come with 1 terabyte of Microsoft OneDrive storage for a year and a year of Office 365 Personal Edition and a $25 gift card to the Windows Store. And in some cases, a year of free, quote-unquote, 4G connectivity, which I don't know when that means HSDPA or LTE or I have no idea, but that's only on certain models.
Yeah. So, again, kind of a cheaper option. They throw in all that kind of stuff to kind of get you hooked on Microsoft services, right? And presumably they can knock a little bit off of the price because of that. So cool little options to see, I think.
Yeah, totally.
I think for the power users, they're just going to ignore this. But for the rest of humanity, I think some of these could be kind of interesting.
High school and college students especially.
Yes, yes. All right, well, let's turn off the afterburners. Taylor, if you are ready, you can undo your seatbelt and perhaps make a gin fizz.
Well, my gin fizz is made. I had it shaken up as we had the afterburners on, so we're all set.
Oh, good. Okay. So you won't need to take, what was it, exactly 90 seconds or however long it takes to make one of those?
2 minutes, at least. Two minutes of vigorous shaking.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the end user stories, and we've got some more Apple News follow-up. And apparently there was a pretty nasty-looking bug in iOS 8 where if you went into reset all settings, it would actually erase a bunch of data from iCloud, particularly the documents from iCloud. So that seems pretty nasty.
Yeah, that is really nasty. I have definitely used that before. It's a good thing I didn't try it in iOS 8. But this story was from a couple of days ago already. They have already released a new update to iOS 8. So if you are using iOS 8, make sure you download 8.0.2.
Yeah, and I thought I would take this opportunity to remind people that you should probably be backing that up somewhere. The cloud is not necessarily your only backup that you need. You really need to have a copy somewhere else just in case this very kind of thing happens.
Yeah, many iOS users may not even realize this, but it's good and fine to set your primary backup to iCloud. It happens automatically every time the screen is off and the phone is plugged in. But you can also make manual backups through iTunes.
Yeah,
and so it's a good way to have a backup to your backup.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good idea.
But that wouldn't necessarily cover the things that you have stored in your iCloud app data or your iWork data. Anything that your iOS apps automatically store in iCloud, you can't necessarily back them up offline.
Right. Well, there must be a way to do it from a Mac or something, right?
Nope.
So it's more like a Google Doc in that case. It's purely in the cloud.
Yes. There are certain elements of your iCloud data are cloud only. That's just how they operate.
Right. Okay. So it's more like, sorry, I said Google Docs. I meant Google Drive. So like if for example, we do the podcast notes in Google Drive, if they went away, we really wouldn't have a backup now, would we?
Right. Exactly. You count on Google to keep that for you. And so in certain cases, people count on iCloud to hold on to their data. And sometimes you don't have an option.
Yeah. Okay, well, word of warning, if you have your update, you should download it. So one more Apple follow-up. We talked last week about the bendiness of the new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, and it turns out to be a little overblown. So we speculated on this last week that we thought, well, okay, this is probably more hype than is really necessary for this, and it's probably going to turn out to not be such a big deal, and that seems to be the case. So Consumer Reports did a test by they fixed either side of the iPhone, and it looked like a little kind of soft piece of wood that they were depressing down into the middle of the screen. So the way they tested it, it started to deform at 90 pounds of pressure, and it finally tore apart at 110 pounds of pressure. So to put that in perspective...
Now, that's for the iPhone 6 Plus.
Right.
And so you can compare that to the HTC One M8, which deforms at 70 pounds and separates at 90 pounds. The iPhone 6 is 70 pounds and 90 pounds, so the 6 Plus is actually... more resilient and more durable than the regular iPhone 6, but neither are as resilient as the iPhone 5 or the Galaxy Note 3.
Yeah, and also the LG G3 was the winner in this category, and it tore apart at 150 pounds of pressure.
The chart I'm looking at says the G3 tore apart at 130 pounds of pressure, and the Galaxy Note 3 tore apart at 150 pounds of pressure, which was also the amount of pressure it took to break an iPhone 5.
Oh, right. Okay, I misread this. So, yeah, at 150 pounds, the Note 3 gave away.
Right.
And 130 pounds, the G3 gave away. Okay, yeah. So I just misread that.
So the takeaway here is that it takes a lot of force to bend an iPhone 6 or an iPhone 6 Plus, along with most other modern smartphones. It's definitely not as strong as the iPhone 5 and 5S, but it's a lot thinner.
Yeah, so we were seeing kind of an isolated incident somehow, and this seems to be not that big a deal in the end, so... if you were going to go for these devices, I'd say don't worry about it too much.
Yes, I'd say that's fair. Maybe be a little bit careful, but in no way is regular wear and tear going to destroy or otherwise deform your phone. If your phone gets bent, if you buy an iPhone and it gets bent near the weak point near the volume buttons, you can just take it to an Apple store, and they'll take a look at it and probably be able to help you out.
Yeah, I'd imagine if they saw any sign of a bend whatsoever and you took it to the Apple store, they would replace it immediately just out of kind of embarrassment. I don't know if Apple would actually decree that to the Apple stores, but I bet you
they never would.
Yeah, I bet you that would be the case. Just a hunch. All right, well, let's move on into something kind of interesting. Noted that BitTorrent is adding a kind of way to charge for some kind of for distributing content. So they're calling it a pay gate, and this is to a BitTorrent bundle. So they call it a quote-unquote direct-to-fan publishing platform. So it's basically a form of DRM that limits you in some way. Like, you can only download the content X number of times before it cuts you off. And it allows the author of the content, or, you know, whoever the producer of the content is, to charge for that kind of content. And it's notable kicking off is with Tom York from Radiohead is releasing an album for $6 on this platform. and they take a 10% cut, I guess, of the purchase price. But I thought this was cool, not because maybe in and of itself it's cool, but because in the larger picture of what BitTorrent is in the industry, it's viewed as solely a piracy engine. And here we have an additional feature to it that allows people to charge for content and really just uses it as a serverless distribution mechanism. And I think that's a really cool option to explore. And I wish we had taken the technology that is BitTorrent and explored it a little further and tried to turn it into a business model instead of immediately shutting it down because of all of the piracy aspects of it. I feel like there are a lot of upsides to this kind of technology, and we just squashed it immediately because it was being used for piracy instead of trying to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I think this makes a lot of sense. I'm sure that there will be some pushback because BitTorrent has kind of become the technology of free, unencumbered internet with all of the privacy and piracy concerns that go with it. But there's no reason that BitTorrent can't be used legitimately in order for people who want to sell something to be able to sell it securely. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, certainly. And I think we just kind of gave up on it because of all of that. So that was disappointing because you saw this fantastic distribution mechanism. And for whatever reason, as an industry, it was largely ignored. And I feel like just because it was used for piracy at first and we didn't know how to kind of charge for things over it, everybody just gave up on it. So I'm glad, you know, I don't know how successful this will be, but I'm glad to see that at least somebody is trying to use this fantastic distribution technology.
Yeah, it took a long time, longer than I would have expected to get to this point. But it seems like a fairly slick interface. It's basically payment agnostic. You can pay with a credit card or with PayPal or whatever, however you choose to set it up on your website. The encoding happens separately.
Yeah, so anyway, I didn't want to dive too deep into it, but I wanted to just acknowledge that it existed, and it's kind of going through a trial right now with this Thom Yorke record. So we'll kind of see how that goes and see if there's any kind of useful information that comes out of that. And we'll see if the technology known as BitTorrent can actually be a distribution platform that can actually make money for people. So we'll see how that goes.
Cool. So another thing we want to acknowledge this week is the bug that has come to be known as Shell Shock.
Yes, so this is another bug that has gotten a cute name and a logo. We talked about Heartbleed previously, and this one turns out to be a little bit worse.
Yeah, so this, if you have any Linux or Unix-based computer, which includes all Macs running OS X, you are potentially vulnerable to this. It's a bug inside Bash, which is built into the operating systems of Linux and Unix and OS X.
Yeah, so Bash is the command line terminal that you use, and basically it really applies to web servers more than it does end users. But what it means is that the people who own the servers out there on the internet have to go update their operating system so that they can get the patch for this. And there is a patch now, and Apple has indeed released a patch. And the other thing is that if you were on some kind of network that, like Starbucks, that's unencrypted, and you know, you have a web server running of some kind, you know, like some kind of media server or something like that, some kind of app you've installed that has a web server built into it, if they have Bash in that application, then they could be vulnerable. So if you are running anything like that, you want to make sure that if you are on a public network, that you want to lock that down and make sure that there is an update for that thing that is using that web server. And other than that, I think consumers can largely ignore this, although there have been a couple demonstrated attacks that can happen this way. So largely, it's just the message is that this is a bug that happened, and it mostly affects web servers, and take your updates if they're available.
Yes, absolutely. Particularly if you are running OS 10.7 through 9, get your updates from the Apple Store as soon as possible.
Yeah, and if you're running any kind of Linux distro, then you'll definitely want to do that too. And again, I had to go update my my servers for my personal blog and that kind of thing. So just good to know that it's out there. And if you see an update, definitely take it. That's all.
Absolutely. All right, so I want to talk about something else that's out there, and it's carbon dioxide. And this is my green tech story for the week.
And there's a lot of it out there, it turns out.
There is a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it's almost like we breathe it out or something.
Well, that's not even the majority of it. For a long time, the overwhelming producer of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was volcanoes, and they're still a really big one. But human directed activities are causing more and more carbon dioxide emissions, and most of it is not coming from our mouths and noses. We are up to above 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide on average in the atmosphere at large, and that is higher than it's been in a million years or more. And so we are trying to figure out what to do with it. That's what green tech is all about. And one crazy idea that's been bandied about plenty of times is carbon sequestration, which basically just means literally pulling carbon dioxide molecules out of the atmosphere and burying them under the ground or the ocean. Now, that is all fine and works in theory and could potentially work if we could figure out some way to capture that much carbon dioxide, but then the question is, what are we doing to the ground or the ocean when we do it? So this is all really hypothetical and experimental, and there's no working plan to actually implement it anywhere in the world. But as a test to see what would happen if we did try to sequester carbon underwater, a group of researchers conducted an experiment off the coast of Scotland to see what would happen if you injected carbon dioxide in a solution under the seafloor and to see how well it would capture the carbon and how much it would affect the area around the site of sequestration. So they found that over at least the short term of the study, they were able to sequester 85% of the carbon they attempted to inject, and that there was some minor superficial damage to the seafloor, but that the equilibrium of the ecosystem was by and large unlikely to have a significant environmental impact. So one step potentially down out of many for the possibility of carbon sequestration. So what does this mean? We're still producing a lot of carbon dioxide. The solutions such as carbon sequestration are possibly viable, but a very long way from working. We have a lot more to do getting the amount of carbon that we're currently emitting reduced so that we will be able to deal with sequestration issues 20 or to 30 years from now, minimum, when we might be able to affect these ideas on a large scale.
All right. Well, I think the idea is that we should be looking at reducing the CO2 that we throw into the air via other mechanisms. But if for whatever reason we can't do that effectively enough, then perhaps this is something that we could do to mitigate some of the effects.
Perhaps. This is just one small test in one far-fetched theory about how to do that.
Right.
So it was a test that went pretty well, so it's still a possibility, but we do need to mitigate our carbon emissions before we think about doing anything like this.
Yeah, so this is just a proof of concept, really. It was an experiment, and we need to see if it can scale and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even about scale. It's not even about proof of concept. It's proof of theory. It's like a skin test. If you don't know if a substance is edible, you rub it on your wrist first to see if it's going to cause your skin to break out. So we've passed this test. We still don't know if it's an actual solution.
Cool. Well, we'll keep this and many other things that we can do about this in mind as we go forward. And I'm sure we'll be talking about something similar in Greed Tech in the coming future. So with that, let's move on to our tip of the week. And you've got us covered this week. What's going on?
Yeah, so I found an article from Craig Hockenberry at Furbo.org who was talking about in-app browsers. Now, if you have an Android device or iOS device or a Windows Phone device, I'm sure that basically every platform does this.
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah, if you open up an app, sometimes the app will have a link in it, and if you click it, it'll open up a browser still inside the app. Now, we all have lots of apps on our phones, and plenty of them have these browsers, and it's fine to click the link and follow it and read whatever article it sent you to. But you should be aware that any third-party app that lets you access the internet at large has the potential to spy on you as you're using it. So it's dangerous to send out private or personal information using these in-app browsers for any browser that you don't trust, and I mean really trust. It is generally considered much more safe to use a purpose-designed browser, such as Internet Explorer on Windows Phone, or Safari or Chrome on iOS, or Chrome or Dolphin, or whatever else you want to use on Android. Basically, a browser that's built by a reputable company that builds browsers.
A trusted vendor.
Not just somebody who designed an app that lets you use a browser within it. Because they can install keyloggers and they can send your usernames and passwords back to the developer of the app or to some other third party. Or they can access any other type of personal information that you put into that app. And so with apps in the iOS App Store especially, there are regulations on how the developers can deal with your personal data used inside the app. But there are no safeguards protecting you if you use
Once you leave.
A browser from within the app. There's no way to prevent that data from being logged.
Right, so you really have to trust the maker of the app to be sure that, nothing bad is happening. Also, there's this notion of you really have no idea what is happening inside of that browser. You know, you don't know if it's over HTTPS. You don't know, you know, what the cert is. You don't know a lot of things. So, that's probably a good practice that unless you really trust the application maker, you probably shouldn't trust an in-app browser like that. So, for example, I would say LastPass has an in-app browser, and I know they use that, and they autofill forms and stuff like that, but I would absolutely trust them because they're basically a security company. But if you're just trying something out and you don't know a lot about it, you know, maybe you don't need that feature.
The point here is that you should be careful of third-party apps, especially if they direct you to a website in a browser inside the app. If you want to keep browsing or enter personal information, you should use a purpose-built browser, not one that's built into an app. And with that, I think we can move on to our app pick of the week, which is not even an app at all, really. It's actually a Chrome extension from the awesome folks at Lifehacker.
Yeah, this looked really cool, I thought, because I didn't know that Netflix had some notion of an API that was open enough for people to make third-party apps like this. I thought they had closed it down.
Yeah, so I guess it's pretty new. Netflix has just started offering HTML5 playback support on their website using Google Chrome. And some of the authors at Lifehacker have put it upon themselves to use that HTML5 player and the new Netflix API to develop a Chrome extension called Flix Plus. So it does things like it makes it easier to navigate Netflix suggestions. It'll hide spoiler images and text, and it won't. It gives you the option to keep the credits full screen as they're playing. You can give half-star ratings, and it has a bunch of other enhancements that are really pretty cool. You know, when Lifehacker makes an app or an extension, it's usually because they have identified something that no one else has done, and they have thought really hard about it.
Yeah, and I do wonder if they're using this without Netflix's blessing, and that perhaps it might get shut down. But there's a lot of, there seems to be some good ideas in here.
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently, Netflix's API is only being tested on a trial basis, and may be shut down soon. But
yeah,
hopefully this app will keep working after that. But in the meantime, use it while you can.
Yeah, so I guess we'll see what happens. I wonder if they, you know, they knew about that, so I'm nearly certain that they had planned ahead for that. So very cool to see.
Yeah, cool indeed.
All right, well, with that, I think we can let the stories pile up, and we can try to align them together with the right colors and that kind of thing. With our kicker.
I'm just waiting for that one long, narrow story.
Yeah, right. And it's never going to come, Taylor. I'm sorry to say.
So if you hadn't figured it out, because we're being kind of obtuse, we're making Tetris jokes, because apparently Hollywood is developing a Tetris movie.
What?
A Tetris Hollywood movie.
How does that work?
Well, there was a Mortal Kombat movie, there was a Battleship movie.
Why not Tetris?
Yeah, why not?
All right. Well, I'm not sure how much plot could be had with a bunch of floating blocks.
Lots of plot. I mean, just think of the soundtrack.
The soundtrack would be amazing.
It would be epic. Anyway, we don't really know all that much about this supposed Tetris movie yet. It may never come out. A lot of things can happen between the initial development and the release of a movie. But we do know that it is the same studio behind the 1995 edition of the Mortal Kombat movie.
Hey, you know what would be hilarious is if they just trolled everyone and all it was is that you got to watch somebody playing Tetris with the great soundtrack and all.
Well, the chairman of the studio who's putting this Tetris movie together said that they have an epic sci-fi story that they're going to tell.
All right. Actually, you know what would be a great story is the story behind the development of Tetris, because that's actually a pretty interesting story. So,
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I'm not sure I would see that in theaters, but I would probably be interested.
Yeah, I'd probably watch it on Netflix, is my guess. I'm still hoping they'll just troll the audience and just release Tetris. That's all.
That would be great if you could play it.
No. That's the point, is that it's a one-way medium. So you just have to watch somebody lose terribly at Tetris.
No, it would be really fun if you could actually play Tetris on a movie screen.
Actually, yeah, that would be pretty cool. Or maybe like the Dallas football stadium screen or something like that would be cool too.
Oh my God, that'd be crazy.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll have to sign up for that next week, because that is the end of the show, and I believe it's time to get out of here. So, Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you, perhaps using Tetris in some way, how would they go about doing this?
Well, I will just go ahead and spell out my Twitter handle, at TaylorPhone in Tetris Blocks.
Okay, good, good. All right, so I expect a...
So you would have to spell out your Twitter handle in Tetris Blocks if you wanted to contact me.
Right, yes. So if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes, and I will also spell it out in Tetris Blocks.
Your handle is way too long. It'll never work.
It probably won't work. Will
you
it?
Reach the end of your name.
Yeah, I don't think it would work. But for Taylor Phone, perhaps. So we'll have to see if you can make that work. And if you do make it work, we'll put a link in the show notes. Not really, actually. All right, well, at any rate, it's time to get out of here. So thank you everyone for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can leave a comment on the post when it goes up, like our commenter did previously. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We are @theenduser. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr, Futurist Prime.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.